1980, grew up in Umeå in northern Sweden, now lives in Stockholm where she's a teacher of creative writing. Her first poetry collection stroke poetic prose novel, The Machine Girl's Testament, was published in 2006. This revolves around football and personal loss. And if you've ever been to Umeå, you'll know it's a big place for football. She's written a variety of critically acclaimed novels, among them A Declaration of Love and You Go North in Order to Die. Great title. Norrut Åkerman för att dö. Her second collection of poems, Counting Book, Räknaboken, is as much a collection of aphorisms as it is a veritable textbook. She also writes and directs for theatre. Whatever the genre, she's been known for her linguistic density and what one critic has called an alarmingly poetic suggestion. I don't know whether that's an English translation that gives quite that phrase, but you'll hear shortly. And her first collection of poems was translated into Icelandic in 2014. So we'll start with Liz, who will read her own work, and she'll then hand over to Ida Linda. Thank you.
Bird. When I became a bird, Lord, nothing could not stop me. The air feathered as I knelt on my open window for the charm, black on gold, last star of the dawn. Singing, there came throstles, Jenny Wrens, Jack Squalors swinging their anchors through the clouds. My heart beat like a wing. I shed my nightdress to the drowning arms of the dark, my shoes to the sun's widening mouth. Bed. Found my bones hollowing to slender pipes, my shoulder blades tufting down. I spread my flight greedy arms to watch my fingers dueling like 10 hummingbirds. My feet callousing to knuckly claws. As my lips calcified to a hooked kiss. Silence. Then an exultation of larks filled the clouds. And in my mother's voice chorused, take flight, chick, go far for the winter. So I left girlhood behind me like a blue egg and stepped off from the window ledge. How light I was as they lifted me up from Wren's nest, bore me over the edgelands of concrete and coal. I saw my grandmother waving up from her fold, looped the infant school and factory. Let the zephyrs carry me out to the coast. Lunars I flew, battered and tuneless. The storms turned me inside out like a fury. There wasn't one small part of my body didn't bawl. Until I felt it. At last. The rush of squall thrilling my wing. And I knew my voice was no longer words but song. Black upon black. I raised my throat to the wind. And this is what I sang. The silver birch. Let me tell you about the sex I knew before sex. In the beginning, when I was a creature, when I took the bit of your hair between my teeth and pushed your face to the silver birch while you whimpered at the fur of me. how I came alive in dens and copses, in the tall grass where the sky lurched violet. Yes, those days, when I was neither girl or boy, but my body was a sheaf of unwritten upon paper, now folding, unfolding, origami in new. Days pale as the silver birch, when sex was a pebble thrown into the pond of me, rippling out. When I held your fingers in my mouth as the woods hummed electric with sensation. Now they sang, now. And everything was sex then, although I couldn't name it. It was the scar upon your shoulder, an arrow of light through the beaches. Day, days wet as cuckoo spit. When I lay skin bare in the field, every insect, jack in the hedge, every bowing poppy touching me. Oh, my body was a meadow then, and you could lie in me forever and still not be done. This poem's about the year when something very different happened. It's called The Year We Married Birds. That year, with men turning 30 still refusing to fly the nest, we married birds instead. Migrating snow buntings swept into offices in the city, took flocks of girls for Highland weddings. Magpies smashed jewellers' windows. Kites hovered above bridal shops. A pigeon in Trafalgar Square learnt to kneel. Sales of nesting boxes soared. Soon cinemas were wild as woods in May, while restaurants served worms. By June, a Russian kittiwake wed the minister's daughter, gave her two freckled eggs and a mansion on a cliff. My own groom was a kingfisher, enigmatic, bright. He gleamed in a metallic turquoise suit, taught me about fishing in the murky canal. We honeymooned near the wash. The salt marsh is booming with courting bittern. When I think of that year, I remember best the fanning of his feathers on my cheek, his white throat, how every building, every street rang with birdsong, how girls' wedding dresses lifted them into the trees like wings. This last poem's called Taps. And as well as being the military song, Taps is also the song that the girl guides sing at the end of their meetings to close their time together. So the names of the birds in the poem are also the names of the patrols or the troops in the girl guides. Taps. Death came for me in my time, through the poplars, where I'd pitched the small tent of my body and lain down inside it, all my white bones surrendering, as in those dawns at Girl Guide Camp, when I woke pressed like a bookmark between the opening pages of other young women, and when I lay still, I heard it. Come wrens and robins, sweet blackbirds, with your hair newly feathered. Come, kingfishers, with your burnt sienna neckers and teal blouses. Come flitting through the beaches, embroidering the woods with your voices. Come with your arms full of ferns. Come with kindling and moss and a pair of silver saucepans clinking taps. Come still dreaming girls from your canvas nests. Come now, for the sun lifts the veil of night. Quickly, girls, come.
Thank you. Well, I'm so delighted to be able to introduce our next Versopolis poet, Ida Linda. Ida's striking debut collection, The Machine Girl's Will, which she'll read from today, was published in 2006. It's at once a poetry collection and a poetic prose novel, which revolves around the themes of football, the mechanised body and grief. Ida grew up with football. Her father was a coach and both she and her sister played until she suffered an injury. The poems in the collection use the language and the experiences of footballing in an attempt to explore and untangle some of the great incomprehensibility of life and loss. And they explore the relationship between the machine girl, the narrator, and her father in a really unsettling, melancholy way. In one poem, which I just adore, she tells him, "One will never experience as many World Cups as one thinks during one's lifetime. The final 90 minutes plus extra time is nothing other than waiting for death." I'm so excited to be able to hear Ida read her own poems this evening, so please join me in giving her a really warm welcome, Ida Linda.
Thank you, Liz, and Neil, and Glenn, and thank you, Ledbury Poetry Festival, for having me. I start off reading a little bit in Swedish, so you hear the melody, and then I'll try to read to you in English. I hope you'll understand. Det är jag som är maskinflickan. Alla ska dö, men jag ska dö först. Min bror Sören går på stadens alla fotbollsmatcher och samlar pantburkar. Han åkte till Stockholm en gång, även om ingen i efterhand kan förstå hur det gick till. Det var en bra match den där gången i Stockholm, brukar Sören säga. Sörens röst är svår att höra, som att det alltid faller snö mellan honom och hans omgivning. När tränare Stig går längs sidlinjen ropar han efter honom: "Stig! Sticke! Stiggan!" Sören säger till kvinnan bredvid att Stig, det är en bra kille han, och fortsätter att leta. En dag ska Sören panta alla burkar och bli rik. Då ska han köpa en present till Stig, eftersom Stig gör ett sånt bra jobb. It is me who is the machine girl. We're all going to die, but I will die first. Sören, my brother, goes to all the city's football matches and collects empty cans for the deposit. He went to Stockholm once, even if no one afterwards can understand how he did it. It was a good match that time in Stockholm, Sören would say. Sören's voice is difficult to hear, as if it is always snowing between him and his surroundings. When coach Stig walks down the sideline, Sören cries out after him, "Stig, Stigge, Stickan!" Sören tells the woman next to him that Stig, he's a good guy, and carries on with searching. One day Sören will get the deposit back on all the cans and be rich. Then he will buy a present for Stieg, because Stieg does such a good job. It is me who is the machine girl. We're all going to die, but I will die first. I can bake bread. I read fast. I have a tattoo. I have two questions. One, what will you do with my dirty laundry? Will someone pick up my knickers, press them to their nose, and say, God, how I miss the machine girl? Two, what will you do with my perishables? Can one drink a dead woman's milk? It was father who got Søren his job. Søren would ignore the sign he had always so carefully obeyed. Keep off the pitch. Trespassers will be prohibited from attending national matches. Søren would paint the beautiful white lines confining the players, and he looked at me straight and said, it is like snow. They have the same function. It was the first time he walked across a football field. His head sought out the well-known iron away from the grass. The temple bone met the machine. Father said the blood quickly poured over the sideline. No football fields have pink lines. When the coffin is carried alongside the fields, the earth is lying face up. At the funeral, father said, those who God loves die young. Jag tog burkarna. I 7 dagar stod jag på Konsum och pantade. För pengarna köpte en present som tränare Stieg inte ville ha. Stieg ville knulla maskinflickan för att se hur döden ser ut, och jag tänkte att döden ser ut som min bror Søren. I utbyte mot samlag spelar alla spelare i sorgeband för min bror. Hemmalaget vinner med 4-1 i säsongens sista match. I took the cans. For 7 days I returned the cans for their deposit. For the money I bought a present that Coach Stieg did not want. Stieg wanted to screw the machine girl to see what death looks like. And I thought death looked like my brother Søren. In exchange for intercourse, all the players wear mourning bands for my brother. The home team wins with 4-1 in the last match of the season. I have to tell father about my tattoo, 'cause he'll be the one identifying me at the morgue. No, that's not my daughter, because she has no tattoos, and I will lie alone under the headstone. The tattoo is of 2 trees and a person whose back is turned towards them. My father is the football ref, who is always running around with a red card in his hand, a constant reminder to the players that they are only playing by his grace. When I am going to sleep, I jingle words in my head. I have this in common with my father. But when I ask him to tell about the trees, he is silent. And I talk about the birch outside my window, say it's taller than the house itself, and that when I sit at the kitchen table, the testament winds its way around the trunk. I have told my father that one will never experience as many World Cups as one thinks during one's lifetime. The finals 90 minute plus extra time is nothing other than waiting for death. My father often talks about Gary Lineker, a whole career without ever having had his name on a red or a yellow card. I ask what Gary Lineker was so afraid of. But father won't answer. His only son is dead and his face becomes another. What has been waiting behind comes forward. I see a new vein on my father's body spread down from the neck down like a river delta across his chest. The blood tries to find a way past the sorrow. He dies on a Sunday. A tree falls over him for no apparent reason. The football ref is dead, and no player wants to comment on his death in the paper. Everyone knows that God did it. My father only lived by his grace. The years settled themselves like extra rings around the iris, and the sorrows altered the acuity of the pupil. At the cemetery, the headstones stand to attention for those who lived facing the sky. The red epicenter sometimes bursts across the eye. Eventually, the trees grow new rings around their trunks, the earth erodes, and yet another farmer sells his land. Time moves quickly when people die, says the Samaritan home help before she goes out to the kitchen. It is me who is the machine girl. I lie in bed, hear her arranging the milk and the refrigerator. We seldom talk to one another. I should tell the home help that we are never so afraid of death that we won't die. The home help comes once a week. We both know that she's the one who will find me, and that is her job. I could have got a job in the forest. I, who survived everyone, remember that I was born a motorbike, that I was immortal, but that my oil was replaced with blood. Do you hear the children trying to learn machine songs in the schoolyard? Here are all papers in order. The best buy date of the perishables extends a week ahead. The clothes will go to the Salvation Army. I have bundled my dirty knickers. I put them here by the foot of my bed. Throw them away. I will rise again when the cogwheels are put in place. I am the machine. And God, with his big fingers glowing with oil, picks me apart, bit by bit, cleans every nut and bolt, places them all on a white sheet. Jag är maskinen, och Gud med sina stora, lysande och oljiga fingrar plockar isär mig, bit för bit, tvättar varje skruv och mutter, lägger dem alla på ett vitt lakan.
What a wonderful start to our reading. The next pair brings together Wales and Lithuania. Marian Jordan, some of you may have heard him earlier, standing in for Don Patterson, poet, editor, musician. He was born in 1985 in Cwm Llynfell, South Wales, studied mathematics at Oxford, and while at Oxford he won the Newdigate Prize. His first collection, Moonrise, from Seren in 2008, was shortlisted for the Ford Prize for Best First Collection, and he has most recently published Regeneration with Seren in 2012. He's the editor for Gatehouse Press and its literary journal Lighthouse, which is a non-profit enterprise seeking to provide opportunities for new writers from across the UK, and he also performs as a fiddle player playing British and Irish traditional music. And he's going to read 10 minutes of his work, and then he'll be introducing from Lithuania Aivaras Viknis. Aivaras was born in 1983. He studied real estate management in Vilnius. His first book was published in 2007, and he's worked as a journalist for the Lithuanian Respublica Journal, and he's also reported from Afghanistan. He's twice received the Young Emerging Poet Award from the Lithuanian Poetry Festival, Poetry Spring, in 2008 and 2010, and he's co-organizer of another Lithuanian festival, which translates as Literary Slide of Vilnius, and he's edited three of its anthologies. And his second collection was published in 2014 and received the prestigious Young Jotvingian Prize for Young Poets. So would you please welcome, first of all, Marian Jordan.
Hello, and to those of you who were in this very location this morning, yes, I'm afraid I am no longer Don Patterson in what has turned out to be a disastrous career move. That being said, I am going to only read one poem that I read earlier. The rest will all be new to you, or some of it will be anyway. A horse in the dark. Quiet. Quiet. Do not dream it is the owl parting from the starlight, the water muttering in abandoned mines. It is the stillness, falling and pooling, drop after drop. It is the clouds spooling past on wires. Soon you will hear oaks pushing their mouths to the soil's tap. The rushes drinking far down the hill, the lidless quartz blink. At the snap of a twig's shadow, and nothing so breathless, it champs at a giant sky. So, that first poem was from my first book, and as I explained this morning, I wrote a lot of it sort of in my head, wandering about after dark. But the sorts of things that I was sort of thinking about at that time, a lot of science fiction. I'm really quite into my science fiction, I still am. And the best subject, of course, of pretty much the greatest gift that one could have for poetry and science fiction is Yuri Gagarin, the Russian cosmonaut. And so this is my little elegy for him. Yeah, he was just kind of an amazing, inspiring guy. For the cosmonauts. I, Yuri Gagarin, having not seen God, wake now to the scrollwork of a body, to my own white fibres leafing into the bone. Know that beyond this dome of rain, there is only the nothing, where the soul sweeps out its parallax like a distant star, and truth brightens to X, to gamma, through a metal sail. So I return to you, cramming your pockets with the atmosphere and evening news, fumbling for gardens in the moon's shadow in its waterfalls of silence. I wish for you familiar towns, their piers and amusement arcades unpeopled at dusk, the unicorn tumbling by on china hooves behind the high walls of park. Among congregating lamps. May you find earth rising there between your steepled hands. May your voyages end. May you have a cold unfurling of limbs each morning when I am fallen out of the world. So skipping on a little bit, as I mentioned this morning, I'm a huge fan of Welsh medieval literature in many of its forms, actually. But generally speaking, my poems on sort of lengthy and complex genealogies never really make it past the draft stage for some reason. So that being said, I've mostly focused on stuff that people can engage with. A really interesting story for me is the story of Magnus Maximus, Maxen Wledig in Welsh, not least because he's the subject of one of the most famous Welsh language protest songs. If people have heard Yma Ohyd with Ar Log and so on, he's the subject of that, or at least he kind of gets the song going. Yeah, it's not very many protest songs that start with a failed 4th century Roman emperor. But that's poetry and protest for you. It really draws you in. But this is kind of my take on it. And, you know, to my mind, it's Magnus Maximus's failure to become a real Roman emperor that kind of sticks. And he looks like quite a failure in this poem to me. This is Braidoid Maxen Wledig. The dream of Maxen the Emperor. Down the long shaft of the cairn, Maxen rides, out of his titles and sunlight, grey as the stopped air. It takes him 1,000 years, and he, feeling the still warm bones slip through his hands turns to see the sun reaching its noonday fingers to hold his skin in its rags, and nothing. Soon he must ride back. Out of the other world's dark he moves, fumbling, and the land changes. I think we've quite got time for just maybe one or two more poems at the very most. I'm afraid that, well, many of you will also have seen George Surtees at this festival already. He's been and gone, I'm afraid. But George has been a big influence on me and a really great mentor, actually, over the years. And I wrote this poem for him at his retirement, thinking back over all the conversations that we had when I was his PhD student, sort of turning up every 2 weeks to drink tea with him. Yeah, he's a swell guy. This is The Ordinary State of Things, and it's for George Surtees. In a bar, where rain pours down the walls, the ceiling daubed with cubist ravings of a suicide. It's one window looking out on a courtyard where great aunts, some of them 6 feet tall, go to light cheap Russian cigarettes and sit giving death the evil eye, or Napoleon, or whatever pipsqueak is passing. The record player knows only gloomy Sunday. And the music strikes up with angles stranger than the door jams, as though a jazz band, trapped in the caved cellar by a Soviet bomb, had forgotten to ask for their rider, or a Roma dressed in an ancient morning suit was pulling the strings from his fiddle as it neighs in disappointment. And listening to this, in another century, on a phonograph, carved in the shape of an owl bequeathed by a long-forgotten Transylvanian grandmother, is the man who takes off his jacket. Slowly pours out the tea, welcomes his guests, protesting that this, too, is the ordinary state of things. And just one last little lyric piece. It's very simple. Frogs. This is not a poem about how my father built a roundhouse and used it as a garage. Nor is this a poem about how he dug a pit in its cold clay, lapping its walls with breeze blocks and pink cement. This is not a poem about how he cut a sump in its northeast corner, setting a pump to chuckle away its oily damp. This is not a poem about how with us in early morning frogs would come from the dazzling grass to shelter in that earth-smelling cloister, or how we would find them trapped, lying like tarry leaves against the concrete, their eyes milky, uncaring stars. Nor is this a poem about how one June we worked together, fixing the suspension on my beat-up red Fiesta, him on one end of the bolt, and me on the other, until at last the bolt seized and we resolved to drill and break through the holding nut. No. This is a poem about how, as he drilled, the frogs watched those bright scarves of metal fall from the bit, how, dumbfounded by his love, reaching down into their prison, they looked and shivered and were not moved. So, all that being said, and still not being gone past, it's my intense pleasure to introduce Ivaras Viknis. Now, as you've heard, he's from Lithuania. He's not just a talented poet, but a prize-winning poet. And of his most recent collection, and this is what really sort of caught me, his editor and one of the sort of most recognised Lithuanian poets said, well, firstly, he is a poet, which, you know, you can't ask for better than that, really. It's the highest praise, almost, that I think most people can be afforded. But he followed it up by saying, He is clinging to life with his poems. And this is something that really struck me as being, yeah, that's exactly what's happening here. Because, as you will hear, it's a poetry that is almost full of struggle. Some of it's political struggle, some of it's emotional struggle. Sometimes it's almost wholly visceral in that approach to struggle. And, you know, maybe that's not unusual. The condition of being a poet perhaps is often associated with struggle, as many of the people who will be reading and watching here tonight will perhaps identify. But I think what really marks Iarus's poems out for me is that his poetry has that sense of the preciousness of whatever we win through that struggle. Even when we win nothing at all, even when we lose, his poetry is never anything less than wholly present, that it's never anything less than being completely real, very much, if not from the heart, then intense in that presence. So I hope you will enjoy it as much as me. Iarus.
Good evening.
Berniukai žaidžia karą. Atvažiavo vandentekio remontuoti, atvilko įvairiausios technikos, kelias dienas nesiliovė, išrausė tranšėją per visą kiemą, didžiausi kalnai abipus. Dabar tai jokių sušiktų šautuvėlių, jokių griūk negyvas, dabar tai jau iš tikrųjų. Tupim skirtingose fronto pusėse, žemių pilnom kišenėm, molio pilnom širdim, svaidom grumstus ir akmenis, sutemus, jau visiškai sutemus, išlenda motina pro virtuvės langą, dairos girta nemato, pradeda žviekti kaip keulė, sukos namo pasakiau, bet kur tau namai į fronte pats įkarštis, švilpia grumstai ir akmenys, žiežirbos pilasi iš ausų, galiausiai liekam tik brolis ir aš, guzas mano kaktoj, ašara jo akyje, juodas virtuvės langas moja užuolaidom pasitikdamas, o vidury giliausios nakties, motina staigiai pašokusi, mūsų tipena žiūrėti, gulim tokie vienodi, kad vos beatskirsi, kuris labiau nebegyvas.
Yes, I'm going to be reading the English translations. Boys playing war. They came to fix the sewer pipe with all kinds of machines. Working for days, they dug a trench through the yard with giant mountains on either side. No more shitty guns for us. No more bang, bang, you're dead. Now it's for real. We crouch on separate sides of the front, our pockets full of earth, our hearts full of clay. We throw clods and stones, heaving clods and stones. When it gets dark. Completely dark. Mother leans from the kitchen window, looks around, drunk, not seeing, and starts to howl like a pig. Bitches, come home now! But what is home when the front is boiling over? Clods and stones whistle by, clods and stones flying, sparks shoot out from our ears. Finally, there is just my brother and I, a bump on my forehead, a tear in his eye. The black kitchen window waves its curtain at our return. At midnight, in the deepest heart of the night, mother suddenly rises and tiptoes into our room. We lie so similar. We are so similar that you could barely tell which one of us was more dead.
Akmens amžius. Akmenys lygiai kaip žmonės mėgo sakyti, kiekvienas su savo slaptų gyvenimu, kieta tartum žemė atmintimi. Pamenu, tvirtos ir dailios gaudavo stvoros, vertos visų tų premijų, kurias dalimis prašvilpdavo. Mano tėvas buvo galingas tvirėjas, daug galingesnis už tuos, su kuriais mane lygina neišmanėliai kritikai, sunkus nei jo akmenys, gal net sunkesnis už visą priekabą, pririnktą per akmenkasi kur nors ties biržais. Du visada nešiodavo kelnių kišenėse, pajuodusius ir sudiržusius, kumščio didumo, neduoktų švenčiausias jai išsitraukdavo. Mano jaunesantis tėvas vis dar yra kertinis šiurkščiam akmenų pasaulyje, šitiek sutvėręs per savo gyvenimą, šitiek per jį sugriovęs.
Stone Age. Stones are just like people, as they who had a secret life like to say, hard like the ground of remembrance. I remember how walls would turn out strong and smooth, worthy of all the prizes which we would mostly squander. My father was a mighty maker, far mightier than those compared to me by ignorant critics. Heavier than his stones, maybe heavier than his trailer, filled with stones that he gathered near Birchai. He always carried two in the pockets of his pants, the size of fists, blackened and callous. You could say your prayers if he pulled them out. My father, who is not, is still my cornerstone in this harsh stone world, having built so much in his life, having demolished so much.
Kito gyvenimo. Ilgų distancijų mokyklai nemėgau labiausiai. Šaudavau staigiai į priekį, lėkdavau, kiek kojos neša, po rato imdavau dusti, nervingai dairytis per petį, žiūrėti, kiek atitrūkau, ar niekas manęs neatsiveja, būti pirmą man reiškia viską visiems įrodyti, bet sykį, būdamas 10 ar 11, kritau kaip negyvas į drėgną stadiono žolę ir išgulėjau, kol aplenkė mane visi, netgi mergaitės. Paskui atsirado mergaitė, kuriai nereikėjo nieko įrodinėti. Gulėjome dviese toje žolėje ir tiek tos mergaitės teliko. Dabar, kai ilgos visos distancijos, bandau jas žodžiais įveikti, nes viskas, kas man nutiko, seniausiai pavirto žodžiais. Žodžiai privalo išeiti iš manęs. Dabar man reikia žodžių kitų, kad vėl gyventi pradėčiau. Dabar man reikia kito gyvenimo.
Another life. In my school days, I hated long distance running. Shooting suddenly in front, I'd fly as fast as my legs could carry, panting after a lap. I would nervously look over my shoulder. How far ahead? Are they gaining on me? To be first meant to prove everything to everybody. But one time, running 10th or 11th, I fell like a corpse into the damp stadium grass and lay there until they passed me, even the girls, except for one, who didn't need to prove anything. We lay there together in the grass, and that was all. That girl remains now, when all the distances are long, and I try to overcome them with words, because everything that happened to me has turned into words. Words that have to come out, but I need different words now to begin to live again. Now I need another life.
Thank you.
Great, such variety. I hope you get a sense of this, of what the Versopolis actually produces in terms of conversations between poets, poets reading one another. It's great. The last poet in this part of the evening is going to be Mort van Howert from Belgium. I'm going to ask Eleanor Rees to say a few words to introduce her, because Kim Moore can't be here. Eleanor's not going to read her own work yet. She's going to read in the second half. So just to say a few words first about Mort. Mort van Howert is a writer and text on stage performer. In 2011, her first poetry album was published by Querido Amsterdam called I Am Possible, and it was awarded the Vroux Debut Prize, a prize for debuts by women poets. In 2014, We Are Parallels was published, a book you can read as a poetry album, as a meandering story, or a compilation of sad jokes. Maud examines creative ways to bring poetry on stage. She's given performances in several countries and won a number of key slams and poetry contests. She has a master's degree in literature and linguistics from the University of Antwerp, and another from the Theatre Academy of Antwerp, where she currently teaches. So would you first of all welcome Eleanor, who will then welcome Maud.
Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce Maud van Howert. I'll just add a few details to the introduction there. I also have on my biography that Maud is also an active participant in the popular TV show Everybody's Famous, where she performs a poetry slot every Monday. And she's also won the World Championship of Poetry Slam and is known as an excellent performer of her work. So I have the great pleasure to introduce her work, which is both surreal and defamiliarises the everyday with humour and a wry wit. She presents fragments of the real world turned upside down and inside out, misdirecting our expectations and fixed views of reality. Her work is accessible and playful, written for performance and the page, the language contemporary, colloquial and concrete, whilst also finely absurd. I'm excited to hear her perform this dynamic poetry in person, and it's my great pleasure to welcome her to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I was never introduced twice. It's really such a great honor for me to be here. I just arrived today and I immediately fell in love with Ledbury. So I'm really looking forward to discover the whole program the upcoming days. And thank you also the other poets. It's so lovely to hear and to see you. I'll read some poetry in Dutch, my mother tongue, and I'll try to read some fragments in English. I know that I will make a lot of mistakes, so please don't shoot me for that. I'll do my best. Perhaps interesting to know, I will not give the translation in English of all the fragments that I will read in Dutch, so probably there will be fragments you will not understand at all, but that gives you the possibility just to listen to the sound. I have forgotten what it feels like to wear frog face paint. The way the paint dries in the sun and cracks when you smile. How I got scared because I thought I was suddenly changing into a very old frog. I've forgotten what it was like to sit on my father's shoulders, laying my hands on his head as if to protect him. I've forgotten who was in my class, who had the most beautiful pencil case, who I wanted to kiss first and who called me once fat as Africa. I once forgot to bring my guinea pig in out of the sun, and when I went back into the garden, he was lying there like a piece of toast left to go black in the toaster. I've forgotten what I thought back then when I thought about death. I've forgotten so many names. I've forgotten the name of the group leader at camp who insisted on twisting my hair into a bun every single day. The name of the man who stitched up my head after I fell off my bike in the rain. forgotten why I pulled my sister's hair. So often she had to get a hairpiece. I've forgotten why I stood on a stage, why all the people looked in the same direction, and I was the only one looking the other way. I've forgotten why, as a child, I masturbated thinking of an enormous hairy Jesus, a bulge in his loincloth. I've forgotten everything from the second line of the song, Je n'ai pas peur de la route. I've forgotten what the gypsy with the highly mobile eyebrows, like dark veils, red in the palm of my hand. In other words, I've forgotten my future. I've forgotten how much I loved you, though I did write it down in a notebook with my signature at the bottom. Forgotten where exactly your lips crack in winter, and how you sleep like you're in a coma, nails pulled up or stretched out, and then we'd fight over the sheets, how in the bright light of Sevilla our pupils contracted. But I don't forget what I've forgotten. It's more that what I've forgotten is what I think about most. Like what my mother meant when I still fed as Africa, and my guinea pig still soft, asked her why we said forgotten and not forgetted, like fretted, pirouetted, and regretted, and that she, while folding the washing, mumbled as if sliding the words in between my clothes, forgetting is never regular. Is het een hart dat bonkt? Of is het de cadans van een trein wat verderop? Is het een hart dat bonkt? Of zijn het de voetstappen van een manke op de kasseien? Is het een hart dat bonkt? Of zijn het toeklappende deuren na echtelijke ruzies? Of zomaar, door de tocht, is het een hart dat bonkt? Of zijn het de bassen van een feest bij de buren? Is het een hart dat bonkt? Of is het het instemmend gehum in een gesloten mond? I would like to show you my second book, which was published this year, and this book consists of 200 pieces or blocks. I don't call them poems, but blocks. And in fact, you could read them just on their own, but you could also decide to read one after the other. And in that sense, it is, in fact, one long poem. As a long, long walk through a metropolis, a very big city. So that's the contrary, the opposite of Ledbury. Yeah, mine. And I will read you the beginning of this book, and we are starting our walk underground in the metro station. Naast mij zit een vrouw. Ze weent en zegt, excusez-moi. Ik zeg, ce n'est pas grave. Zij zegt, si, c'est grave, vous n'en savez rien. Dat is waar, zeg ik, weet er helemaal niks van. Voilà. Ons gesprek is geen einde, geen begin. Zoals alles in een stad valt het ergens tussenin. The woman sitting next to me is crying and says, excusez-moi. I say, ce n'est pas grave. She says, si, c'est grave, vous n'en savez rien. That's true, I say, I don't know anything about it. Our conversation is not a beginning, not an end. Like everything in a city, it's somewhere in the middle. A handbag growls. Everyone looks up. A woman zips a dog into view. Hush now, mommy is here. She zips back, catches the dog's skin. It yelps. Hush, she hisses, and the crowd screams, "Mommy is here." The crying woman has a big lump of dough on her lap. She starts to knead it. I always do this when everything is in danger of falling apart. The more you knead, the better it sticks together. Even before she can bend over the lump, strange hands grab at the dough. Ringed hands, clammy children's hands, wrinkled hands, the hands of a Chinese too. He doesn't knead, he picks at it. The woman slaps him in the face. "I don't have any wrinkles," she says. "Life's just pinched my cheeks." De vrouw naast mij weet niet meer. Het deeg op haar schoot staat in piek en ik verlies haar in de massa. De metromassa die zoals de zee pas breekt aan het oppervlak, pas breekt en schuimt boven gronds. The woman next to me has stopped crying. The dough on her lap is wispy. I lose her in the crowd, the metro crowd, that just as the sea only breaks on the surface, only breaks and foams above ground. I was at the funeral of a lady some months ago. And after that funeral, some weeks after that funeral, I met her husband. And he said to me that he was so upset about the sound system. And first I didn't get what he was talking about, but afterwards I understood. And if I'm thinking about it right now, then I believe that, yeah, perhaps that was the saddest, that the sound system, dat de geluidsinstallatie, dat zij daar lag, dat de kerk vol, dat er heel veel bloemen, and that the geluidsinstallatie. That she was laying there, that the church full, that there were so many flowers. And that the geluidsinstallatie. Dat zij daar lag, dat de kerk vol, dat er heel veel bloemen. Dat er iemand was die speciaal uit Duitsland, dat hoorde ik later. Dat de broeken netjes gestreken, dat haar zoon voor de gelegenheid zelfs nieuwe schoenen, dat er heel veel bloemen. En dat de geluidsinstallatie. Dat zij daar lag, dat de kerk vol, dat er heel veel bloemen, dat er kaartjes, een mand vol, dat zij van overal mensen, dat zij nog veel te jong. Dat haar dochters, dat haar zoon, dat haar man op de eerste rij alleen nu, dat ik daar lag, dat ik achteraan in de kerk, ik had haar nooit gekend. En dat de geluidsinstallatie. Dat zij daar lag, dat de kerk vol, dat er heel veel bloemen, dat de zijbeuken vol, dat er wierook, dat de priester ermee zwaaide. Dat hij zei dat zij nu net zoals die wierook naar de hemel zou kringelen. Dat ik dacht naar de hemel kringelen, de wierook is werkelijk de slechtste metafoor voor een overleden moeder. That she was laying there, that the church full, that there were so many flowers, that the sight ails. Full, that there was incense, that the priest swung with it, that he said that she would rise to heaven just like incense, that I was thinking rising incense is really the worst metaphor for a dead mother. Dat iedereen dacht, wat als mijn moeder ooit, wat als jij ooit, wat als de kerk volde, dat er heel veel bloemen, dat op zijn minste geluid is. Dat zij nog maandenlang zelf naar de passende muziek, dat hoorde ik later, dat de broeken, dat de bloemen, dat de kaartjes, dat de parkist, een portret, dat ik achteraan aan de kerk en dat ik dacht dat wij de dood niet tot daar aan toe, maar dat wij niet eens de geluid, dat ik naar huis reed, dat I was driving home, en dat ik dacht, als mijn moeder ooit, if one day my mother... Als jij ooit, if one day you, dat als de kerk vol, dat als er heel veel bloemen, the church full, many flowers, dat ik ervoor zal zorgen dat op zijn minst de geluidsinstallatie, I will take care that at least the sound system, fine. Perfect.
I think at this point I should thank Stuart at the back for our own wonderful sound system. We thought, having heard five poets, that you might like a brief break before we have the other four. This isn't an interval where you can go off across the Prince of Wales and not come back, but some of you might like to go to the toilet or just have a breath or have a chat amongst yourselves. And in 5 or so minutes' time, I'll call time and we can come back and hear the other four wonderful poets. Thank you. Well, welcome back to Versopolis. Before we start the second half, I must apologise for not having mentioned the translators from the first half, who were Marianne Andrikic... No, that's your... Got it wrong again. The first half of the translations were by David Colmer, Rima Uzgiris, and Irene Ermark Hall. Right, and the second half is going to start with Eleanor Reith, who is paired with Maria Verenchova. Eleanor Rees was born in 1978 in Birkenhead, Merseyside. Her pamphlet, Feeding Fire, received an Eric Gregory Award in 2002, and her first full-length collection, Andraste's Hair, was published by Salt in 2007 and shortlisted for the Ford Prize for Best First Collection and the Glenn Dimplex New Writers Award. Her second collection, Eliza and the Bear, was published by Salt in 2009 and has just been published by her third, Blood Child, from Pavilion Poets. Eleanor works in the community as a freelance poet and she lives in Liverpool. Maria Verenchova was born in Bratislava. She graduated in film, screenwriting and dramaturgy from the Film and TV Faculty of the School of Dramatic Arts in Bratislava, FTV VSMU. And she completed her postgrad studies in Paris. Currently, she lectures on the history of film, of world film, at FDFVSMU, and she's the editor of the film journal Kino Icon and Translate. Her first collection was published in 2003, and she's since published two more, and her poems were translated for Versopolis also into French, as well as into English, and she speaks all three languages. And the translations of her for this part of the reading were by Marianne Andrichik. So would you please welcome Eleanor Reese first of all.
Hey. Night River. East to west, west to east, wetness crawls the promenade wall. Oil and chemical, salt and tar, the night is in my throat. I consume distances at the edge of the river, 3 a.m, solitary, held only by the rain and the sky. The wind's touch is courageous. The stars are stags, antlers pointed at each new shore sailors discover far from here in some sunny waters. I open to it like a mouth and sense her shining full height on the horizon, as if the horizon is a ledge she balances upon. And hovering, I rush to her, her starriness, her electric pulses that beckon, she widens. I immerse myself in her thighs, her whiteness, her sighs. I am her. The sea is a boat. We ride until the dawn. So, the first poem's from Andraste's Hair that was written 10 years ago, which is really quite disconcerting. I'm going to read a short extract from my second book, which is called Eliza and the Bear. Eliza and the Bear is actually a long poem, about 35 minutes, so I'm just going to read the first section of that piece. It's about a woman who falls in love with a bear and the problems that creates. I did not know my lover was a bear. I've seen him bear. I've seen him leave his skin. He roars, bear wet, grisly, shakes his head, crawls into bed, places a bloody paw on my breast. In the morning, a paw mark on my skin. It masks freckles, masks my nipple. I did not know my lover was a bear. I did not know he was on all fours all night, crawling the streets looking for the wilderness. I did not know he wanted to go back to woods and harsh brackish skies. I did not know he wished to go. He never said, "Sweetheart, I'm a bear, I'm leaving now, I'm going home." The night is a blue-green ocean I swim in. He comes and sees me on certain nights, other nights he wanders the woods. Oh, bite the light, sweetheart, bite the edges, be bear-like. I can see you being bare as you wander, eyes like reservoirs gleaming at trees, at weather, at colours that spin in your dreams. When you see salmon, the smell of fresh blood glimmers in your mind's eye. I wait for you, I wait in our cave. I wait in bed, coiled in sheets and red linen. My hand touches the spaces you made before you left for the hills. I did not know you had gone to the sea. You took off out onto the waves like a landlocked sailor freeing yourself from grey sands. I did not know my lover had gone to the sea. I woke with salt on my lips. I woke with sand in my hair. I woke with the sheets soaked black with oil and tar. I woke with a gull on the dresser. I woke with your hand waving in the mirror, slowly topping from side to side. I woke with your body bobbing outside the window on a wave of rain and cloud on a winter's morning. I cried for your drowning. I cried for your sunken ship. I did not know my lover had gone to sea until the thunder on the river woke me and the empty space in my bed sat upright, dressed, put on its sailor's hat, kissed my flushed cheeks and ran unrepentant out of the door. And so it goes on. So I'm just going to read two poems from my new collection, which is called Blood Child. Slight change of tone. This poem's called The Birdmen of the Far Hill. Out on the hill, wearing black like light, carrying torches, they cross the ridge, into the valleys flicker and break, into spasm of flashes, triggering moon into darkness. They are watching the river's pendulous hook against the rust of the landmass, hoping for endings and clods of soil to fall sharp into the felt of the sea. They are out on the hill, predatory. They carry heavy stones in their pockets, cold against their legs, and are looking for strangers, unknowns, tornadoes, in the back of next door's shed, in the glimpse of your eye. They gabble, scribe hieroglyphs into the mud by the golf course, to break open your breath, seal you within their cages. Feathered bodies swell at the thought of your quietness. They want to flatten your thighs. They want to admit all their hurt. They want you to take them until you are as barren as the winter ground or as pockmarked as the muddy field. The mulch you find yourself in is sticky, wet, filtered mountain, tree bark, excrement. You are made into slope, turfed over, never found, speaking only out of the roots of newly seeded grass, the football pitch studded with boot marks. You speak into the dusk, but unheard, now detrious. The river drags your remains, your soil, you crumble out into the reaches of the estuary. Spawning salmon swim over your smallness. Fish scales and meaty hulks groaning against your dispersal into salt and sea vacuum, dark depth, alteration. And another change of tone. I write free verse poems, and I've recently been writing ballads. So this is a ballad of the Edgelands. It's called Sealskin. Sun shifts through the clouds' broken shade. A red fox flits like a bee. She runs as fast as the east wind blows from the motorway to the sea. In the house at the edge of town, her family keeps within. A girl's shape in a leaded jar, the memory of her skin. Her body forms from shifting sun, cloud water becomes a lake. As she runs like wild earth turns, leaves from the springboard ache. And she runs without her skin, a glimpse from a passing train. A shimmering ghost in fading dawn through the bracken by the lane. She pounds the frantic carriageway like a hunted deer, weaves amongst the cut of cars, yet only he can see her. Her body forms from shifting sun, cloud water becomes a lake. As she runs like wild earth turns, leaves from the spring bud ache. And he knows where this will end, turns the key in a car engine lock, glances again, breathes in and out, the horizon is in his look. And she runs like the wind is full in the sails of a tilting boat, calling to the land as she goes, new buds make me a coat. And calling to the land as she runs, cloud, give me your grey faces, like a sky before the thunder sticks to my open spaces. And calling to the land as she runs, soil in the tractor's furrow, give me your warm, damp earth, your grainy, dark tomorrows. A field rises like a swarm of flies, till drenched in mineral brown, throws dry earth over her bare shoulder, she is strata like a mountain. Her body forms from shifting sun, cloud water becomes a lake, as she runs like wild earth turns, leaves from the spring bud ache. He turns the car into the single track which leads towards the gate. A no-entry sign swings in the rain. A girl perches, quietly waits. In the oilseed crop she runs like time and on through the silent yard. Fattened pigs all kept in lines, hens held in soundproofed barns. He stands on the muddy track as she comes, mesh of leaf and soil, rain heavy as the ocean floor, her belly bulbous as a seal, and blubbery and flecked with grey, his skin a soft furry sheen. He holds her in his arms and sighs, you run like you can swim. Across flat fields pours the sky, sea escaped from a bulging coast. Culverts swell till they burst like stars, and the two seals are submerged. Their bodies shift with changing tides, and strong-born waves begin. They swim like wild earth dives, as salt crystals encrust new skin. Thank you very much. Okay, it's my great pleasure now to introduce Maria Verenchakova, which I should be able to say by now because I have been practicing. I decided to introduce Maria's work in her own words. So I'm just going to read you a short quotation from Maria about her poetry. She says, "Frontiers of the body are limits of immediate perception. Imagination and reflection go further, of course, but the body represents to me the primary perception, the real, if you want. But the body can be also victim of phantom pains, the psychosomatic diseases. It can be subject to the mind's horsing around. This is what interests me even more. The body is literally the physical presence of the subject, which means the object is the subject and vice versa. It's a sentiment that I would agree with entirely. So I'd like to welcome Maria to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you, Eleanor. And thank you, the Ludbury Poetry Festival. I'm so honoured and happy to be here among such great poets. It gives me stage fright. And I'm happy that Eleanor stays by my side, because
yes.
I will read first in Slovak, and she will read the translation in English, into English. The two poems I will read first were written almost 15 years ago when I came to live in Paris. And despite the fact that I was admitted to a really good school, I had scholarship from the French government, I felt much closer to the excluded, homeless, hopeless, alone, lost, mad people. So, in the city of Dax is all about that. V meste psov. Kryštály vyrástli prirýchlo. Rozdaviť zubami. Poškrabať krk. Tenkými prstami poplátne nezvučne okresliť zákruty. Tunajšia voda pri ceste. Snaď podľa tajného receptu procesom očisty zachovať kalo. Pach. Vole pretrvať. Pach syra a rýb. A drobné škrnky na povrchu. Nič iné, než ešte včera lahodná potrava psov.
In the city of dogs, the crystals have grown too fast to crush between one's teeth, to scratch the neck, to copy the curves on canvas silently with slender fingers. The water here by the roadside, perhaps to preserve sludge by the process of sewage disposal, according to an old secret formula, the smell, the will to survive, the smell of cheese and fish, and small stains on the surface, none other than yesterday's delicious dog food.
Aj myši sú rýchle. V podzemí, po farbách, pod sedadlom hľadajú jesť pomedzi dva vlaky. Načisto ohluchli. Riadia sa ako ty chvením kolies a lúch.
Mice are fast too, underground, in colours, under the seat. They seek food, in between two trains. They went completely deaf, guided, like you, by the trembling of wheels and legs.
Posledné škrupy mi predošli dní procesom očisty zachovať kao. V snavutom zrkadle ďalšia z tvojich tvári, za každým patriaca grase, čo zakliali.
The last shells of previous days, to preserve sludge by the process of sewage disposal. Another of your faces in the darkened mirror, each time belonging to a race that is enchanted.
Literárnej čajovni. Literárnej čajovni, kde sa tesne nad podáhou hromadí chlad. Ťažoba. Nad pohármi a vedľa bzučivých hlasov gymnaziálnych pedagógov na dôchodku nemožno spolnúť plecami. Čítam, ako sa patrí. Čítam. Už vieš, že vo väčších mestách vniká reč dodržania tela a chtiac, nechtiac implikuje samostatnosť.
In a literary tea room. In a literary tea room where coldness gathers close above the floor, oppression. Over the glasses and next to the humming voices of retired grammar school teachers, it's impossible to move one's shoulders. I read the proper way. I read. You already know that in big cities, speech permeates the posture and willy-nilly implies independence.
Presné rozmery úzkosti. Ako sa nebáť určenia vlastného času? Isté ženy na fotografiách z mladosti, taká Ingeborg Bachmann, nedokážu pôsobiť ako cudzie, ako neznáme. Už bezvolne si uvedomíš ďalšiu stratu. Komu si včera potmeti slanosť na rameno, telo už uplynul. Dobre aj tak. Z minulého sa pohyb tratí a tlak na pokožku by bol len zbytočne bolestivý.
Exact dimensions of anxiety. How not to be scared of the determination of one's time. Certain women in photos of their youth, Ingeborg Bachmann, say, cannot look foreign, unknown. With no more smell, you'll apprehend another loss. The one whose shoulder yesterday you pressed your nose to in the dark. He too has passed away. Even so, it's all right. Movement disappears from the past and the pressure on your skin would be uselessly painful.
No je ti aj slabo. Čo všetko za teba ešte nebolo. Priznávaš tým stvrdnuté kolená a ochabnutý úsmev. Horkú chuť kávy, ktorej pach ulpiená pod nebí. Zostávame sedieť. Ešte je potrebné prediskutovať, prečo sa niekde z tropu ústnej dutiny hovorí pod nebie a inde zase palác. A tiež pomenovať únavu zvlečúceho sa dňa. Zo spomalených gest, zo znehybneného chrbta. Nakoniec sa zhodneme, že postačí akékoľvek krátke psie meno.
But you also feel faint. Is there anything you haven't been through? Thus you admit to callous knees and a feeble smile, a bitter taste of coffee, the smell of it clings to your palate. We remain sitting. It's still necessary to discuss why somewhere the top of the oral cavity is called a roof and elsewhere a palate, and also to name the fatigue of the dragging day, of slowed gestures, of a stiff back. Finally, we agree that any short dog name will do.
So I will now try to read in English. Any mistakes? With my Central Eastern European accent. About Paris, again, when I came back after completing my studies and then study again. The summer is not going. It stays like inflammation on stuffy roads, warm stone, no trace of steps, yet humidity in the air. Wounds are not healing, the same movement every afternoon. To wipe the dust from one's eyes, and the oil from hot wheels. October. Not even return. Continuance in crevices. The city doesn't remember. Nor do you wish to. Numb fruit soles, chapped hands. Why not admit a strait, a passage? From behind a corner surfacing instead of another memory, a street. Another one. The same. And a madman on the platform, quite desolate. No one is scared of him anymore. Change, être un mur Sébastopol. On the very top, a man is sleeping in his socks. A bandage sticking out of one, but hardly anyone dares cover his nose. Behind a window without blinds, someone gets drunk, quite solitary. Behind a window with a blind, I change my makeup. I don't air the place. I silently invoke the telephone till finally I fall asleep. A finger code, nose, noise, secret entrances, to be angry with oneself for being in the first moment unrestrained, for being in the second reasonable, and resent one's loneliness. Where's the virtue in that? From the point of view of eternity, it doesn't matter whether in this world side by side with this body, or some other, from the momentary point of view, to choose emptiness and wait. An old woman, in fact, rather moldered than old, perhaps senile and possibly bewildered for ages past, takes the lift up and down, greets at great length, aloud repeats, yes, yes, over and over again, addresses everyone as madam, sir, with an assiduous smile, and touches children's cheek with her fingers. A pin in someone's stomach, a word in someone's heart. Quarantine, 40 days of silence, a flame, cellophane, a scorched image. You infect the whole colony with yourself, and you're surprised when then they condemn you. And the last one that expresses my state of not be able to speak properly about accidents of perception of time, modes of perception between channels, worldless days, years, periods, centuries of drawing with black lead or burnt sienna on the rock, restless notches, silhouette of clumsy figures, a tangle of lines, animals in motion, millennia of the word, winding of words, round body, lashing, silhouettes of clumsy sentences, space behind them, muting, and a surge of noisy images to unravel, to span, to look like one understands, a hand for joy, to draw, a hand to survive, to kill, a mouth for a voice, a game to lie, to open for someone else, the same to the same Picasso in the cave, and bridges for oneself.
And lastly, Gloucestershire meets Macedonia. Adam Horovitz, poet, journalist and editor, born in 1971 in London, raised in Slad, Gloucestershire. And he's appeared at numerous festivals and venues around Britain since the early 90s. He started at a very young age. In fact, I think I first met him when he was 8, when his poems were published in New Departures. He's been poet in residence for Glastonbury Festival's website, and has published 3 pamphlets, Next Year in Jerusalem, The Great Unlearning, and Waiting for the Flame. His first full-length collection, Turning, was published in 2011 by Headland, and he was awarded a Hawthornden Fellowship in 2012. His memoir about growing up in Cider with Rosie Country, 1,000 Laurie Lees, was published in 2014. And then we'll have Yoko Zdravetsky from Macedonia, born in Skopje, 1985, graduated from the Faculty of Philology. He works as a Macedonian language teacher at the Faculty of Philology in Niš, Serbia. He writes poetry, short stories and essays. His poetry books are Palindrome with double N, House of Migratory Birds. He's also published a poetry book called Cake Out of the Window in collaboration with several poets from Serbia and Macedonia. And his poetry has been included in anthologies of poetry by young authors and translated into Serbian, Croatian, Slovenian, Bulgarian, Spanish, Czech, and English. And he's going to be reading, if I can find it. Sorry, wait a moment. What's the last one? The translations in his pamphlet are by Lazar Popov, Scott Stewart, and Luke Crane. Would you please welcome, first of all, Adam Horovitz.
Straight to Slad, a house built from cloth. I grew up in a house built from cloth, played in the ruins of cottage industry, old stones like teasel teeth chewing at my feet, fragments of industry, their lime wash white faded to a smoker's gold. I grew up in a valley stretched over stone like cloth, rolled footballs and roller skates over sheep-felted grass, built locks in the stream under the old trade road. I grew up in a landscape where hedges and dry stone walls ran through the fields like seams, where the past was a runic language stitched, dyed and woven into oracular hills. Time settles like ordered cloth in these valleys, catches itself red-handed as it is folded back. I grew up watching the past, pulling the weight of the future along the canal's linear thread. Very short note, the phrase catches itself red-handed, apparently comes from the Stroud Valleys, because Stroud made the dye for the Thin Red Line, the army, 100-odd years ago. And if people tried to steal it when it was drying on the hills, they came away red-handed. The next poem was written with the centenary of the First World War in mind. I was asked to write a poem to do with Ivor Gurney. So this is Stopping with a Bicycle on a Hill Above Stroud, Thinking of Ivor Gurney. Five valleys splay below me, like a broken hand encased in mud. From this high point, I see open veins of streams running in rivulets towards the Severn's metallic, distant slice of light and water. I stand beside a hedgerow that's been growing cancerous for years from the broken wall my bike is parked against. It was shrub and bramble when I cycled past it lazy on my way to school. It rages now like a negative of fire held still against the winter sky, and I think of Gurney casting back from Flanders with his pen at a different angle to take the same landscape in as if it were breath. The road is quiet. No traffic on the way from Bisley. Only buzzards and the ghosts of babies whose unchristened road deaths centuries back formed the town below. A new form, the perfections of flowers and petal and blade. But landscapes shift. Wild spaces are surrounded. They look starker for it, stranger, briefly until litter into seeds. Mankind's interactions wane and wax. Old walls collapse. New ones clatter up the sky like angry pigeons. A sheep in the field turns to bleat at me, as if surprised by the tyrannies of change. What would we recognize, Gurney and I? The Severn's progress, like a scarred, unbroken sword shot through with filigrees of winter light. The aching yell of gulls flown eastward after ploughs. The way the sun sinks like a cuticle into a skin of cloud. The foreboding sense, something new we can't be part of. What rides this dusk like a pheromone? The bicycle calls me to the hill, the wind, the last hawk dive into Friday night. No more listening to spectres, no more pauses on cold hills to mourn the sun. The earth that ploughs forgets protestation in its turning. Those last two lines are a direct quote from Gurney. The next poem was written, it was Laurie Lee's centenary last year, and I was, as Neil said in his introduction, I wrote a memoir about growing up in the Stroud Valley, but I was also commissioned to write some poems by the museum in the park. And I took the opportunity, having written this book about growing up in Stroud Valley and Laurie Lee's influence, which was certainly a big one. He was a very generous person, kind of even pressed a fiver on me once outside Stroud railway station, said, here, have a fiver, go get drunk and write some poetry. which I did, and I'm grateful to him for this. But I wanted, with the poems, to reclaim the valley a little. So the pamphlet it's in, Waiting for the Flame, starts addressing Laurie and ends trying to reclaim the valley. This is All I Carry With Me, and it was originally written as to respond to one of the chapters of Cider with Rosie, and I was given outings and celebrations, so of course I wrote a mournful love poem, All I Carry With Me. The party is silent for the brief minutes our hands lock, bound into each other like convolvulus in drunken curiosity. Travelling beyond these steep valleys to seaside or city, all I carry with me is the memory of your eyes catching mine like first sun reaching through the shifting trees, the green of you, the laughter, and the blue. I will seek out the bluebells next year, next year. Walk beyond the wild garlic's white fire, green sky, further away from its consuming stench of celebration, cradling your name on my tongue, balanced between silence and the endless blue. And this is waiting for the flame. This is where people are buried. In rooms made dark by paper, which bursts like frozen lightning from boxes leant against the walls, the blackened beams. Digging in, we find memories bent and stiff in their winding sheets of dust, ossuaries of forgotten sorrow, a paper bag full of childhood's hair. New boxes, packing tape, a hard few days of delicate rehousing. The 70s are flung from the window in a tumble of old-fashioned advertising. Quash, Walker's Crisps, Bulmer's Apple Juice, a cash and carry avalanche, cardboard cities form in the garden, waiting for the flame. I hold letters up for inspection, find poems I've never read in my mother's hand amongst old photographs of her naked in the garden, an awkward delight latched to her face, to her smile. The sun is caught in monochrome. It licks at her hair, her breasts, a fire in the dark. I imagine her clothed and colourful. I put away the pictures, head blurrily down treacherous stairs. These are the archive hours, the times of troubling to look back and back, then forward through the painful heat of curiosity and hope to what can at last be saved. My father, too frail now to lift the boxes, carries memories on his shoulders as if they were wood for some burnt offering. He salts the bread he says he must eat little of with tears. I stand in the garden until the fire dances up and almost out. Cardboard sparks weave amongst heat-stricken leaves, rehearsing autumn. Clouds tuck up the stars, and I am glad I've crawled out of the dust of us into the valley's glittering dress of rain to watch lightning spread in sheets over the hill. There is no thunder now. Only the flame remains. And the final poem I'd like to read. I've come, as you might be able to tell from my surname, from Jewish ancestry on my father's side. So religiously, I'm not Jewish, but culturally, I am. So this means, and it's a delight to be here because of this, I consider myself deeply European. We trace ourselves back to Frankfurt am Main 100 years ago, to Bohemia 300-400 years ago, to Spain, Sephardic Jews 1,000 years ago. My father's family have traced ancestry back. So it is a delight to read with you all. An absolute delight to be European here. Thank you all. This was thinking about the First World War and the commemoration hour last August last year. As a Jew, partially a Jew, I tend to follow in the trait of the people and settle very much on one landscape. But it's always movable. Commemoration hour. A moth-cupped flame sputters out of silence in my kitchen, draws insects whining through the window's crack. They sing like distant biplanes, dogfight dancing at the edge of sight. I watch red wax spill over the candle's battered lip and think of family, long dead, the quiet men on unquiet fronts who let the rituals of their religion slide away, buoyed up on propaganda, desperation, hunger, as they wrote loving letters in the dark, succored only by a single flame, by the guttering distances of home. Oh, how they dreamed of family, gave thanks to God for the minuscule mercies of the Weekly Post when it got through. But even the gentlest men will break inside when bombs and snipers dictate their diet, And when all the animals of hell come crawling out from under mud on sinews of metal clasping at the bone. What precisely did they die for, or limp home wounded with? My grandfather never said, sitting in silence with his memories in the garden of his weekend home, until he was forced to cross Germany's borders and escape into England 2 decades on. Great Uncle Martin could not say. Splintered in 1915 by enemy fire, only his letters remain, regaling his dearest sister Roschen with brotherly bravado, detailing requests for the essentials, paper, food and pens, whatever news might make it through the lines from home. The candle's spitting out its last 100 years on, but still the news is limited and grim. The insect whine of war continues. Tanks rumble through my kitchen whenever the fridge fires up. Commemoration wears an ugly, celebratory mask. Its eye holes stare us down like guns, and from its mouth a fine gas seeps. Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling in the press for ways to not quite say we won, we won, we won. But we won nothing. The war continues in fragments, though no one is yet crazed enough to join the dots. And all I can see in this quiet hour is red wax stiffening on the candle into the faces of all the people that I love. Thank you. It's my pleasure now to introduce Gyoko Strawesk. Thank you. Phew. And as I said, it's a pleasure to be here with all of you, and particularly at a British festival to hear so many different voices. I can't remember now who it was, but somebody telling me that if you can't stand at the door of a poetry reading and not quite hear what actually is being said, but still and not then get a sense just from the sound of it, then it's not poetry. And this has been poetry. We've been listening to you all, so much has been taken away. I mean, and in translation, the poetry of Gyoko creates, I think, a restless space in the head, a meditative world of literal and metaphorical journeying, of change and the borders that you cross to create it. He told me earlier he was interested in human consciousness and how wide it can be opened. And I'm greatly looking forward to hearing him read in both the original Macedonian and in English. So would you please welcome Gyoko.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Ledberg, for inviting me here. I really enjoyed these last 3 days, and it's a really magical place for me. It's like from a fairy tale. I'll start in Macedonian, and then I will read only in English. This one is not in the book that you have. I got the translation yesterday by surprise. A friend of mine read the book and she liked this poem the most. Бог е мојот пастир. Си ја заборавив молитвата меѓу празнословието си. Секој пат одново го загинувам Бога по чекалниците и билетарниците. Тој е благородник. За него не важат пасошките контроли и возните редови на авионите. Ние двајцата секој пат одделно патуваме. И секој пат, секој за себе дома стигнуваме. Прегласни се во мене звуците на тргнувањата и пристигнувањата. Ни требаат векови тишина за одново да се најдеме. Низ шепот во себе те барам, за во исто време да те повикам и да не те избркам. Си ја заборавив молитвата меѓу празнословието си. Заборавив да молчам, да седам мирен, да чекам, на ништо да не мислам. Замижан и насмевнат, ни шепот да те повикувам. The Lord is my shepherd. I've forgotten my prayer amidst this verbosity of mine. I keep losing God in lounges and ticket offices. He's a noble man. He's above passport controls and flight schedules for airlines. The two of us always travel separately and always arrive home apart. Too loudly ring inside me the sounds of departures and arrivals. We need centuries of silence to find each other again. With a whisper, I search for you within, so that I may invoke you and yet not drive you away. I've forgotten my prayer amidst this verbosity of mine. I've forgotten to be quiet, to sit still, to wait, to think of nothing. With eyes closed and smiling, with a whisper, I invoke you. The Lord is my shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. I thought that this used to be a chapel, but I think that I was wrong. I'm not sure. Still, there is a church behind us. Freedom. My granddad enclosed his courtyard with a fence and thus won a plot of land, though he lost the world. And then he started to partition that plot of land and name the gardens. I was a child, and I loved most the little connecting doors. We stake in Paul's bounds. We draw maps with some boundaries and place people there that scan through our bags, asking us where we are going, as though it really mattered to them. Where are you heading, Gojko? Gdje se putuje, Gojko? The border guard asks me at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I, still not fully awake, say to him, home. While thinking to myself, back and forth the earth, or up and down, in space or in time, now or always and for eternity. We are centuries away from freedom, for we still set ourselves free from other people's chains, and we do not feel in the guts the key from the cell in which we are locked. We forget that the coffee we drink to wake up is contained in the residue at the bottom of the cup. Every day we talk about it. We even dare sing about it. It's just that we do it ill, full with fear, instead of love. House for migratory birds. My left shoulder is the swing from your dream. My left shoulder is the swing from your dream. You slip in and miss the morning silence of old men who drink coffee on terraces. The high rise that obscures the sun, or we hide from it. Feet uncovered are hugging in the bottom of the bed. The window wide open, swallowed rags, sky torn from happiness, counted to 10. In the corner, a spider, shipwrecked, stitching plans for a new home. Ours is a house for migratory birds. We are boats of paper in the middle of a flood, longing for ground.
This one is called For Earth Red. For Earth Red. It's a password for the first chakra. When I wrote this poem, it literally healed me. I was feeling bad and I wrote it and that's the way I healed myself. For Earth Red. I descend to my subterranean chambers, to the foundations, where back in days my folks buried something. I descend stealthily, hiding from the world. I steal the key from myself. It is jellied down there. Even fire is burning from the chill. It burns like embers on bare skin and goose pimples because of the ice, fear, foreboding. I reach forth with a candle in my hand. I search through the jars of sweets, bitter, slightly licorice. I sift through all that has passed through me, all that passed before me. I let the air out with the knife so that the stench may leave. I remove the mold spreading on top. I take a deep breath, get a taste with my finger. Jar by jar, I open. I remove the mold. I take a deep breath, get a taste with my finger. Jar by jar. Jar by jar. Jar by jar. Until I find why it hurts so much. And until when? This one is about Vipassana meditation. The body remembers everything. One should sit still for days, be quiet with his eyes closed, but be awake and observe. For days on end, one should bit by bit patiently sharpen up the mind. Not let even a scratch under the nose fly off, not even a dimple along the back, a shimmer of the nerve from the top of the head to the heels. One should stand on the side and observe, bereft of passion of a supporter, free of judgment, no stone cast, no wrath, but no joy either, free of yearning, just as is, prostrate, without the space and the time. And only then can one start. For the body remembers everything. Even the fear of your mother as you were turning in her womb.